Khaleesi.
Khaleesi.
Yes, Khaleesi. Khaleesi. Khaleesi, please be careful.
Khaleesi.
Trust me, Khaleesi.
No, today's episode is not about how you butcher a possible top three shows of all time, how you butcher possibly three or four top 10 characters of all time with bad writing. We're not talking about Game of Thrones, guys. We're talking about Dia Alcaina. Welcome back to Roots, a podcast about greatness. This is Daniel here, so let's get back to business. A ruthless, steadfast warrior, as well as a merciful leader who liberated thousands of slaves, this was Dia Alcaina, a Jewish Berber North African woman, aka the North African Khaleesi, but unfortunately, not nearly as famous as the Game of Thrones character. Dia Alcaina lived in northern Africa at the end of the 7th century. In plenty Muslim sources, she is described as dark-skinned with lots of hair and huge eyes. Fascinated by her exotic image, historian Nahum Schlausch described her as fair as a horse, strong as a wrestler, a true desert woman, healthy and fast on her feet, an excellent writer, and a shooter who never missed. Alcaina is usually described as tall and great of hair, which usually is interpreted to mean that she wore her hair long and bunched in locks. I've learned something this last couple of weeks. The proper name for them is locks and should be addressed as such. Dreads is very disrespectful because there's nothing dreadful about it. White people came up with the term dreads to demonize our natural hair, the natural state of it. That's why they call it dreads, because apparently to them they were dreadful. So I want you to change that in your language, locks. Going back to Alcaina, she has been depicted as fair-skinned or even white, but no, she was a black African queen and would have been dressed in the attire of the royalty of ancient Numidia, a loose-fitting tunic or robe worn with sandals and sometimes belted. She bore many names in legend and historical records. The most evocative is Alcaina, which means sorcerer in Arab language. And that specific name, Alcaina, the one most frequently used by Arabs, alludes to the warrior queen's supposed ability to see into the future. And even though she's a champion of the native North African Imagian people, she's best known by the title given to her by her Arab enemies, Alcaina. Legend claims that she was a Jewish sorcerer who descended from the Beta Israel community of Ethiopian Jews. Born to a Jewish Moorish Berber tribe from what today is Mauritania, some sources claim she was a daughter, others claim she was the niece of Berber King Axel, famous freedom fighter of the Imagian people. And at the same time, it has been argued that she practiced the indigenous religion of Numidia, which included worship to the sun, the moon, and the veneration of one's ancestors. The claim regarding her power of prophecy is in keeping with this ancient belief in which the gods, or the spirits of the dead, could communicate with certain members of the tribe who had the gift of prophecy. Parentheses, I'm learning more and more about how to communicate with the ancestors, and I've seen immediate results. So search for answers in your ancestors. That's the key to our well-being. Myths and legends suggest she could communicate with birds who were able to warn her about advancing armies. This story may have originated to explain her alleged prophetic gifts. Legends also claim she once married a tyrant who was persecuting her people and then murdered him on their wedding night. She headed the resistance to the Muslim invaders of the Umayyad dynasty. They conquered the Maghreb towards the west during the 7th and 8th centuries when Hassan bin Naman, the military commander of the Caliph Abd al-Malik, was heading towards Carthage in order to occupy it. He's thought to have fought alongside Axel, previous leader of Mauritania, who defended, held, and expanded his kingdom during an Arab invasion, and she therefore proved herself in battle. She had a tremendous acceptance by all troops as a competent military commander. After previously losing against Alcaina, Hassan, now holding the northeast regions, he once again attacked Kaina, but this time he had 45,000 soldiers under his command and was prepared to almost every scenario, except that of an army of Berber tribes headed by a woman battling against him. He was so badly defeated that he retreated to Libya, to Egypt, but Berber tribes from all over the Maghreb arrived to join Al-Kaina in her campaign, which they gloriously won after exhausting battles. Diya, being the graceful queen she was, she offered peace, but the Muslim commander would not accept, unless she acknowledged the authority of the caliph and adopted Islam as her religion. As she was so immersed in her own religion with her ancestors, she rejected. She was even quoted as saying, "I shall die in the religion I was born to." Her alleged gift of prophecy is said to have enabled her to foreknow how her opponent would form troops and how they would be reinforced, and even what direction they would come for. That spiritual power has also drawn comparisons with Native American Apache seer Lozen, who was able to anticipate and defeat the US cavalry troop through precognition. So going back to Kaina, she defeated Hassan more than once and even drove him away from the region. Then she engaged in a scorched earth policy to deprive the invading Muslims of any profitable goods, ordering her warriors to leave no crops, no possessions, no livestock wherever they retreated to. And this, of course, led to a loss of support from her people. It may be, however, that the Arab armies themselves used this scorched earth tactic, and later Arab writers attributed the destruction of the land to Kaina. Legends claim that during one of these engagements she had with Hassan, she was vastly outnumbered by the Arab forces should she had to retreat. But recognizing the direction of the wind, she ordered her armies to set fire, which the wind then carried to the enemy. And the Arab army was forced to retreat, and the land was so badly burned that any future campaigns would have to cross an arid wasteland without resources. Okay, so at this point in the story, there are two possible narratives. According to Arab historians, legends, and myths, her first victory by fire gave her the idea to start the scorched earth policy on a large scale. She is claimed to have believed that the Arabs were only interested in the riches of the land, and that if she removed the riches of the land, they would leave her people alone. So she commanded her army to tear down fortifications, destroy cities and towns, melt down gold and silver. So she ordered fields burned, even private gardens were destroyed. But she wasn't done. She allegedly engaged in this tactic to save her people, but to those who lived in the towns and cities and relied on the field to eat, Al-Kaina's policy was disastrous. Their homes, their businesses were destroyed, and the only option given to them was a nomadic wandering in a region which had been largely destroyed by war, even before Kaina set it on fire. This built-up resentment towards the queen replaced the earlier admiration, and it resulted in many of her people turning against her. The other possible narrative is that Arab historians are attributing to Kaina a tactic known to have been used by invading Arab armies elsewhere, in Egypt, Libya, even Mesopotamia. The invading Muslim Arabs, they used this scorched earth tactic to subdue the population. So it is likely that they did the same in North Africa, with later writers blaming the widespread destruction on the warrior queen who led the resistance against them. Whoever controls the media controls the narrative. As Malcolm once said, the media would have you hating the oppressed and praising the oppressor. Stay woke. So it's totally plausible that either Hassan or another commander initiated this policy in North Africa just to demoralize her people, just as they did everywhere else. And it worked. Those who openly supported the queen before turned against her, with all their crops and homes and businesses destroyed. It is also possible that by this time, people simply saw a Muslim Arab victory as inevitable. Even Kaina herself may have felt this way, due to the fact that she later surrendered her sons to Hassan. Owing to her officer and gentle lady ethics, being a true Khaleesi, she set free to all the war prisoners she had captured. So wherever she went, she set free to all slaves, all war prisoners. She set them all free, like a true Khaleesi. She had an adopted son, Khaled bin Yazid, on top of her two other sons, one being a Berber and the other being Greek. She had three husbands forced to satisfy her intense needs, and that, quote unquote, she was addicted to the lusts of the flesh with all her youthful flaming temper. It took Hassan 5 years to recover from all those losses caused by the battles with Diya. Next time around, she got the lower hand, as Hassan had this time a much larger force, since a significant number of her former allies fought against her, including one of her sons. He even informed about his mother's battle plans.
Nigga snitch, nigga hoe, nigga bitch, nigga bitch, nigga snitch, nigga hoe, nigga bitch, nigga bitch.
It is said that prior to her death, using her powers of foreseeing, she turned her other two sons over to the Arabs so they could convert to Islam and escape what would be her own fate. After her defeat, some say she died in battle wielding her sword, but the most accepted theory is that she took her own life by falling into a deep well. Muslims pulled her body, chopped the head off, and sent it to the Caliph. And until today, that same well is called the Kaina well. No legend has articulated or even promoted as many myths, legends, and served as many ideologies as this one. The warrior queen's story has been passed down through oral tradition for about two centuries before it was first recorded in writing. Diya's legend is crucial in Islamic North African history because she represents a moment when the region was reborn and regenerated. There has even been various documented artworks throughout the country that glorify her, including street art on a wall at the entrance to a village outside Tizi Ouzou, a city in north central Algeria, and even a 9-foot statue erected in Bagay, a town and commune in northeastern Kinshasa province, further indicating the extent of which her legend lives among contemporary Algerians. These representations of a female warrior reinforce the assertion by Amazigh activists that prior to the arrival of Arabs, North African women enjoyed greater freedom and status than they do today. She's known over most of North Africa, mostly as a heroine, a woman in who in today's terms would be labeled a liberated feminist. As her name becomes more widely known, Diya Al-Kaina inspires not only her own people, but those everywhere who honor her memory and sacrifice for the cause of freedom. Let it be liberty or let it be death.